time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us this morning live in the studio Larry Doors. Larry is with the Seattle Burma Roundtable, and we're going to be discussing the current situation in Burma. Larry, thanks for coming in this morning.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let me start out and ask you, can you tell us a little bit about the Seattle Burma Roundtable?
Sure. The Seattle Burma Roundtable, we've been meeting on a monthly basis for almost 10 years now, and it includes academics, students. We have a number of human rights activists with experience in Southeast Asia. It's really a great group of people. And we advocate politically on behalf of the democracy movement in Burma, and we also raise money on behalf of internally displaced people who've been driven from their villages inside Burma. So we just finished up our annual fundraiser for that.
All right. Hopefully that went well. And can you give us a brief history on Burma? Because depending on which map you look at, it might have the name Burma over it, or it might have the name Myanmar over it.
That's correct. And on the pro-democracy side, we have a tendency to continue to use the name Burma. The military regime renamed it in 1989, renamed it Myanmar. But we, along with the State Department and a number of other people, continued to use the name Burma. It's a country of 50 million people. It's resource-rich, and it's ironic how often resource-rich countries end up being poor places to live. After World War II, it gained independence from Britain. It had been a British colony right next to India. It's sort of wedged between India and China, so it's a strategic location. There was a period of democracy that they had through the 50s. In 1962, there was a military coup, and it's been under military control since 1962. So now we're looking at, 41 years of military control. In 1988, there was a massive people power uprising, and just millions of Burmese came out to call for overthrow of the military and pro-democracy. And that's the time when Aung San Suu Kyi emerged as a unifying force. She's the daughter of the independence hero of Burma, a man who was assassinated in 1948 when he was only 32 years old. He had accomplished great things before that. So there was this, millions of people out in the streets. The military withdrew for several weeks, and then they came back with a vengeance and just fired upon peaceful demonstrators. If anybody wants to learn about this, there's the Hollywood film Beyond Rangoon, which portrays a lot of the events that took place in 1988. So for the last 15 years, a very brutal military regime has been in control. The democracy movement self-consciously has followed the anti-apartheid struggle, and because the military controls so many aspects, particularly in the economy in that society, the democracy movement said, don't do business there. And so a lot of what we have worked on here in the United States has been to support that point of view. And in fact, there's really only one U.S. company left doing business in Burma, and that's the oil company Unocal. And I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to talk about Unocal before the end of the program. So Aung San Suu Kyi has spent a lot of time under house arrest the last 15 years, the majority of the time, in fact. But she was free for the last year or so until May 30th. And she was traveling around the country holding, not really rallies, but going to open offices of the National League for Democracy, the political party that she heads. And that political party, by the way, won national elections in 1990. The military, under pressure, held elections, but when they lost them overwhelmingly, they decided not to honor the results. Burma is a place where there's a legitimate democratic alternative. They have a background in practicing democracy, and, they have their troubles. They have ethnic diversity, with 35 to 40% of the population being non-Burman. The Burman ethnicity kind of controls the center of the country and much of the politics. So they have, they have their issues, but nonetheless, Burma is really different in that the people have spoken, they've chosen an alternative to the military, they've had practice of democracy, and I think it's a good place for the world to be really asserting on behalf of democracy. On May 30th, her convoy was attacked, and it was attacked by pro-government thugs who the military had set up there to ambush this group, and it seems as though they really got out of hand, and really everybody's very lucky that Aung San Suu Kyi was not killed, but 100 or so people were beaten to death on the road there. The U.S. Embassy, to its credit, immediately sent somebody up country to investigate this, because the military regime said, oh, only 4 people were killed and it was a riot by the National League for Democracy people. But they found bloody clothes, they found broken sticks, they found pieces of rebar. It was all done hand-to-hand on the road, and recently a witness from that attack was testifying before Congress, actually week before last, in Washington, D.C. So after this attack, then the United States responded very strongly. There was a bill all ready to go, and believe it or not, Mitch McConnell, who's not my favorite politician on a lot of issues, is very supportive on the Burma issue. He and Dianne Feinstein have worked together a lot on this. Dianne Feinstein out of California. And this very strong sanctions bill passed the Senate 97-1 and passed the House 418-2. And those are the strongest votes on any foreign policy issue under the Bush administration. So, and then Bush quickly signed the bill. So, there was some momentum that was gained in response to this brutal attack. So now the situation is very bad within the country. You know, the military, it wasn't just this attack, but they cracked down across the country. They closed offices. They arrested people. More people have been trying to escape to go to Thailand. And the key point at this juncture is that George Bush, for the first time in his life, is going to Southeast Asia, the Asia-Pacific Environmental Economic Cooperation, the APEC meeting, is being held in Thailand in 2 weeks. So that's kind of brings you up to the situation right at the moment.
All right, and I understand that recently there was a congressional hearing on the situation in Burma, which several members of your group participated in.
Yeah, a couple of members from the Seattle area went to one of them to testify, and another to kind of lobby because it was obviously a great opportunity to meet with people who were concerned. It was very interesting that 15 members of Congress showed up at this hearing that was on the human rights situation in Burma. And at the same time, Richard Lugar published a piece in the Washington Post, and it was concurrent, and of course these things don't happen merely coincidentally, that accused the Burmese generals of developing closer and closer ties with North Korea. The Washington Times then published a piece that reported that there's a deal being negotiated to provide North Korean missile technology to the Burmese generals. And one other thing is that the generals are buying a nuclear power plant from Russia. So you begin to see, they're already a regional destabilizing force, but it's really upping the ante when you begin to hear about missile technology and nuclear technology. This hearing, really, the fact that 15 congressional members came to the hearing, and just the energy on Capitol Hill suggests that there's more focus on Burma now. Again, I'm pretty generally a critic of U.S. foreign policy, and so, but on the Burma issue, where you have to admit there's relatively little U.S. Economic interest. It's a place where the U.S. can take a stand on behalf of human rights and democracy at relatively low cost. And the U.S. is doing that. And I think, that to some extent we have to give credit where it's due. And it's not a Bush administration policy so much as it's been a U.S. policy since 1988, a policy of leadership on this. And other countries, particularly in the region, are happy to turn their backs as long as they're getting the timber and the other resources from Burma. They're really turning their back on the human rights, the humanitarian situation in the country as well, and that's pretty shameful, frankly, to deny the facts of people suffering. I think is pretty immoral to pretend that it's not there. So, generally the United States is strong, but one of the things that our group here locally works on is to work on behalf of more than 1 million internally displaced people, and we call them IDPs. And they're essentially people who've been driven from their villages by the Burmese army. They're usually of the non-Burman ethnic groups. And they're hunted in the forest like animals. And we're talking about 1 million people. They have all the needs of refugees, but because they haven't crossed an international boundary, they're not refugees in the legal sense, you know? So we try and advocate on behalf of the IDPs, and that was a very interesting thing in Washington, D.C. Lauren Craner, who's the Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, was asked, is there genocide going on in these areas? And he said, you know, I wouldn't call it genocide. Well, crimes against humanity? Yes. Ethnic cleansing? Yes. But genocide? No. And of course, genocide is, again, a legal term that creates obligation. If the United States were to recognize that genocide is going on, then there's an obligation to do something about it. And it's been a situation that we're not very happy with. I was in Thailand in June and met with the U.S. ambassador to Thailand, who in fact is a gentleman from this area, tried to get him to recognize the situation for IDPs, and the conversation was always diverted back to refugees, those who have already crossed into Thailand, and there's more than 100,000 who are you know, refugees as recognized by the United Nations. But that was representative of what's still going on in the State Department, is an unwillingness to look at the humanitarian crisis across the border. And that's because the State Department doesn't want to offend the government of Thailand, which is becoming a very big problem. And there's, you know, people should be aware that the situation in Thailand is much different than it was a few years ago. And politically, they're going backward quite quickly, and it has implications for the situation in Burma.
So it sounds like the U.S., even with the positive developments, for instance, the bill that they passed back reacting to the May 30th incident, you say that we don't have a lot of trade necessarily with Burma, and we placed sanctions on them. So wouldn't that be kind of more symbolic than really having any teeth?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, yes. There was a certain amount of garment manufacture that was coming to the United States. And I think it's ironic because the Unocal investment was grandfathered in under the Clinton administration in 1997. There was a ban on new investment, but it didn't bar the Unocal investment, which was already existing. And, you know, when an oil company is in a direct partnership with a military regime in a situation that's giving them over $100 million per year, it is a little unfortunate to focus on closing down the garment factories that were providing something above $300 million per year of sales to the United States. So, you know, that was fairly significant. It does put more pressure on, but it's just unfortunate that the oil company continues to do business and the garment manufacturers, where, you know, a lot more people benefit from the garment trade. There are more jobs anyway. The oil companies just cut a check to the big guys and say, yeah, you do with this what you please. You know, you're the government, so you get to have it. And so it's, you know, but at the same time, you know, you got to take what you can get in the political field. And this was an important step, but it's ironic that the oil company Unocal continues to operate.
Not to mention the enormous number of people that were displaced by that pipeline and forced, I believe, at gunpoint to work on it, and as well as, of course, the environmental devastation of that facility.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I do want to bring people's attention to. I'm sure we'll be able to talk a little more about what's coming up in the next couple of weeks regarding APEC. But in December, the Unocal Corporation is due to go to trial in California State Court, and there's also a parallel federal court case that's a little behind. It's going a little more slowly than the state case. They're being sued by Burmese, excuse me, from that area, from the pipeline area, who were subject to human rights violations. The allegations are right up to rape, murder, torture, the murder of a baby being kicked into a fire. And they're suing the Unocal Corporation for those human rights using what's called the Alien Tort Claims Act, which is a 1789 law, the First Continental Congress, that allows foreigners to utilize the U.S. court system for things that took place abroad. So it's a really groundbreaking case, and I work with Amnesty International's business group, and we're very supportive of this law. It's very important that people have the opportunity for redress. I mean, that's a human right as well. And the Bush administration is really working against the Alien Tort Claims Act, mostly in principle, because they just don't like any kind of foreigners to be able to sue any kind of Americans. This smacks of international criminal court to the Bush administration. They're fighting against it. They haven't been successful thus far, but it's something to keep an eye on. But that trial is due to start in December, and if I could sit in the front row with a bag of popcorn, I'd be as happy as could be, because we are going to see, when this trial finally comes around, we're going to see U.S. executives having to testify under oath about decisions that they made, and the level of information that they had, and the evidence that we have so far is that they were fully aware that these human rights violations were going on, and the only evidence that I've seen so far is that they were talking about how can they avoid responsibility for them. They were not talking about how can they stop them. So, like I said, I think that's going to be a pretty interesting case, and one to watch, for whether you're interested in Burma or whether you're simply interested in human rights and justice.
And, yeah, holding corporations accountable, which seems to be a harder and harder task these days. So do you have any inside scoop that there might be some good documentation on the side of the Burmese against these corporations that we finally might see some of these CEOs put behind bars?
Well, this is a civil case, so they won't be put behind bars unless, I guess, they fail to pay. The judgment really will be in monetary terms if there is a judgment. But even to get them to sit under oath, it's a good step. And this, the fact that the case has gone as far as it has had implications for other multinationals saying, geez, we don't want to necessarily be pulled into court. We should think about what we're doing. So it has carried the ball a little bit further up the field in any case, however it works out. But thus far, all the documents have been kept secret, but where you do see it is when the judges make a decision, then they quote from the documents. And that's where, even though I know some of the lawyers who are bringing this case, they don't give me any documents. You know, the only stuff that I get to see is what the judges quote. But that's where you see very clearly, and the judges thus far have said so, that Unocal was aware of the human rights violations, and Unocal benefited from the human rights violations. And that's pretty hard-hitting stuff. So if people want to learn more about that case, the website, www.earthrights.org, is a place where you can learn a lot about that. They're very heroic young lawyers who've worked on this case for 10 years now.
And any sense on when the federal case is going to be seeing light of day?
The federal case was continued by a three-judge panel in the Ninth Circuit, and then Unocal asked that it be heard en banc, and people may be familiar with that because of some of the things that have gone on around the California recall situation. That means that 11 judges come back and hear the same case that the three-judge panel heard, and so we're still waiting for the 11 judges to come back with their judgment, but the three judges were unanimous in saying that this case should continue in federal court, so we're hopeful that that's what'll come out. But it's, you know, any trial that I want to move fast always seems to go slowly, and anyone I want to go slowly always seems to go fast, so this one has really taken a long time.
All right. Keep our fingers crossed on that. You mentioned Thailand and that things look like they're changing for the worse there. Can you go into some more detail on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really it's quite outrageous. There, the Prime Minister of Thailand is the richest man in the country, and he's a little similar to Berlusconi in Italy, and he's really put himself above the law. He buys off the media that he can't buy off. He puts pressure on to self-censor. And he does that within the political system as well, and buys people off or pressures those to shut up. But what he has done is put a tremendous amount of pressure on the NGO community, even the Thai NGO community, which for a country of its level of economic development, the Thai NGO community is quite sophisticated. they've also put a lot of pressure on the many, many Burmese who have fled their country on fear of torture and death, and work on behalf of democracy and humanitarian needs from Thailand. A couple of instances. There was a group of women from the Shan ethnicity and the Shan Human Rights Foundation who published a report on the systematic use of rape by the Burmese military. When they go to ethnic minority areas, they systematically rape the women. And that's something, you know, that we saw in Yugoslavia as well. It's a tool of terror. So the Shan Human Rights Foundation and their women's organization published this report, and it was picked up by the wire services. It became a big deal around the world. The U.S. State Department, again to its credit, sent somebody to the border to corroborate these allegations, and they did so. The Thai government reaction was to raid the office of the Shan Human Rights Foundation and the Shan Women's Organization to chase them away, you know, to shut down their operations. And that's systematically done. They're just raiding offices. They steal their hard drive. They, you know, they turn all their files inside out. They ask people about their immigration status, and oftentimes people don't have adequate immigration status. So they're abusing the victims. And they're doing it because the Prime Minister of Thailand has direct business links with the generals in Burma. And it's very, very frustrating. Again, Thailand has been in a slow, steady process toward a more open and democratic political system for decades now. And it's really been reversed. And what we're seeing is that in mainland Southeast Asia, Thailand is moving more toward Burma rather than Burma moving more toward Thailand in terms of political development. And it's a very worrying situation, because, you know, all the trends that we've seen all these years are really being reversed. And, you know, Malaysia is a controlled democracy. Singapore is a controlled democracy, and Thailand is really moving in that direction very quickly now. And it's just very frustrating. And people should be aware that what was going on in Thailand is not going on now. And I think at some point that our campaign, we have a grassroots network here in the United States. We didn't win a vote 418-2 and 97-1 without grassroots pressure on our representatives. We have a good grassroots network here in the United States, and I think pretty soon we need to turn our attention toward Thailand and simply build the awareness that the Thai government is supporting genocide in Burma for money.
Now, are they a democracy there in Thailand? What's the structure?
It's a democracy. It's really, you know, they had a lot of military coups over the years, and so the military still has a lot of influence, but they've withdrawn now from politics. They haven't had a coup there, gosh, in 12 years now. So that's a good sign in Thailand. The royal family, the king is revered, you know, so that the royal family still has a role in politics, but it's usually not an overt role. So you really and then you have the parliament. So you have the three different influential actors in the political system. And the unfortunate thing is that Thai policy is actually not good for Thailand. It's good for Thaksin. It's good for the prime minister. He's making money. He's a man of money, and he's making more money by the policy. But there are definitely people in the royal family. There are definitely people in the military who are saying, wait a second, this is not good for our country. But because of the way the system works, they can't come right out and say it, because they're not supposed to be directly involved in politics. And anybody who is supposed to be directly involved in politics, there's just a very few elected representatives who are willing to stand up and say this, you know, kind of call bullshit and say this policy is against our own national interests, which it is. There's no doubt about it. Because, Burma is becoming more and more unstable. The generals have systematically defunded the public health system, systematically defunded the education system. And so if you look at the prevalence of AIDS in that region, India's worst AIDS problem, with the exception of the city of Bombay, is right on the Burma border. China's worst AIDS situation is right on the Burma border. Thailand's worst AIDS situation right on the Burma border. So, you know, they're spreading disease and instability throughout the region, and the Thai policy right now under this prime minister is supporting that. And it's a recipe for disaster. It's not good for anybody.
What other countries besides Thailand appear to be fairly tight with Burma? How is it with its other neighbors?
Well, China provides military support, provides landmines, for instance. And again, this is one of the things that you don't hear much about. Burma is one of the most actively landmined countries in the world. They're still putting them in the ground. You go to a place like Cambodia or Afghanistan, and for the most part, they're in the ground. They're trying to get them out. Burma, they're still sticking them in the ground. They're buying them for $2 a pop from the Chinese and sticking them in the ground day in and day out. So the Chinese provide a lot of military support and a certain amount of diplomatic cover, but the Chinese really aren't dedicated. They recognize that the Burmese generals, who are relatively uneducated, the guy at the top has a sixth grade education, that they're kind of buffoons and that they're not really good for the region. But China gets some access to the Bay of Bengal, which in China's long-term contest with India, that's very useful to China to kind of surround India. So China, you know, gets something from their relationship and continues to provide a certain amount of support.
But who would they be putting mines in the ground for? I mean, they don't appear to... I mean, their whole military seems primarily aimed at internally.
I mean,
they haven't been attacked or invaded by anyone?
No, absolutely
in years.
Not. Yeah, they don't. They really don't have any external enemies. So it's all for internal battling, and again, particularly against the non-Burman ethnic groups. There's a group called Clear Path International that's based out on Bainbridge Island and working with one of the members of our group who does a lot of medical. He's an MD here locally. They've set up a clinic on the border. This is the first clinic to work specifically on mine issues. And there are just so many people on the border, again, similar to what you'll see in Cambodia, going around with crutches and one leg or no legs at all because they stepped on a landmine. They're just farmers trying to survive. So, they plant the mines in order to fight, you know, and I put that in quotes because it's really a very one-sided situation against the ethnic minority groups. So the relationship with the neighbors, India vacillates. You know, India is a democracy and has had strong, Aung San Suu Kyi lived in India before, but India also worries about growing Chinese influence, and the Indian military has done, kind of made some deals. So the region is not as strongly in support of this as it should be, and that really brings us to the APEC meeting, the fact that George Bush is going to go there. I met with the head of the Thai Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, who's one of these guys who just stands up there and speaks the truth on the Burma issue. And he said, you know, what the United States says, what the president says is really important these days. We need to work on his message when he comes here in October. This is as I was with him in June. Our two senators, Maria Cantwell, and particularly Patty Murray, has been very supportive on this over the years. And Maria Cantwell's office is now also very supportive. You know, we have good relations with our representatives on this. They sent a letter to Bush, along with 35, I think it is, other senators, asking Bush to make a very strong statement on this, saying this is important to the United States, that this region, and again, mainland Southeast Asia is really the... In between India and China, you don't hear about it as much, but it's a very, very important strategic area. If we want to see democratic development around the world and more open societies, Burma is a place that we really need to take a stand. And that's what was asked of George Bush, that when he goes there, that he takes that stand. And he says, people who are working for democracy in Burma shouldn't be abused in Thailand. You know, the abusers are across the border in the Burmese military, and it's about time we faced them and we did something about them. And the other thing that the letter to President Bush asked is that the issue be brought by the United States to the UN Security Council. Some people worry that China would veto anything that got done at the Security Council, but we say, fine, you know, let us see it. Put it on the table. You can't, you can't assume anything. The Chinese, they have never spent much diplomatic capital on behalf of the Burmese. And whether they would stand up for them in the Security Council, we don't know. So let's go there and find out. So that's what we're asking George Bush to do. But most of all, at the same time, to recognize that humanitarian situation, both for the Burmese living displaced inside Burma and for those who are, and there are a million who are migrants in Thailand who, you know, they have take the worst jobs as illegal immigrants do all around the world. And those people really need to be cared for.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. How can people find out more about the Seattle Burma Roundtable?
Yeah, the easiest thing is to email us, and our email is Burma, B-U-R-M-A, at u.washington.edu. And we send out monthly updates and meeting updates, and then we also have a more intensive action list for people who want to participate in that. So just send us an email at Burma at u.washington.edu.
All right. We've just been talking with Larry Doors, who is with the Seattle Burma Roundtable. Larry, thank you for coming in this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.